This sermon was recorded at Christ Church Overland Park, a congregation that exists to be a people fully alive in God's kingdom.
Well, the word Advent, it's a Latin word, and it means literally, it means to come, to arrive. And it's used to describe the arrival of a notable person or a thing or an event. You could say, for example, the advent of television changed the world. In a Christian context, however, that the season of Advent is when we anticipate the coming of Christ, and we think about that in two dimensions. First of all, we look back, and we think about the Son of God and His coming into the world as Jesus Christ, born in Bethlehem. But then we also look forward, and we think about the day when Christ will come again in glory. And so today we're going to begin the season by anticipating the second coming of Christ. The church year always begins with the end in mind, like, where's this all headed? And our gospel reading is from Mark 13. And it's very important. This is a very, like, if you read this chapter, it can be very confusing. And so it's important that we understand the context for what Kirk just read for us. So at the beginning of Mark chapter 13, Jesus is talking to his disciples, and he tells them that at some point in the future, Jerusalem and the temple in Jerusalem will be destroyed. Okay? So they're in Jerusalem. He looks around and he says, hey, see all this stuff? It's going to be destroyed. Verse 2, do you see all these great buildings? Not one stone here will be left on another. Everyone will be thrown down. So that's what he's talking about. And then in verse 4, the disciples ask, when will these things happen? The these things meaning the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. In response to that question, Jesus then launches into this teaching about when the destruction of the temple is going to occur. But interwoven in this discussion about the temple and its destruction, Jesus really is making the point that this destruction of the temple is coming, and that is a foreshadowing of the great judgment day that will someday also come, when he comes again in glory and power. So he's talking about the destruction of the temple, but the destruction of the temple is a foreshadowing of this great judgment day. And then he ends it all by saying, watch, be ready. Now, a lot of people, both inside and outside of the church, have really struggled with this passage and this teaching. And it raises consistent questions. One, isn't this just kind of crazy? We've seen the movies. It's kind of goofy and crazy, and we don't get it. It's kind of fanaticism, And another question it raises is, I can accept that there's going to be this thing called the second coming, but what difference does it make? Like, why do I care now? And then finally, how can we eagerly watch for it? Like, why should I be excited for the second coming? So let's deal with those three questions. And the first one is, isn't this just fanaticism? Isn't this idea of Jesus kind of coming again in power and glory, isn't that kind of like probably what people who handle snakes believe? The sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from the sky and the heavenly bodies will be shaken. At that time, people will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. You know, we love the description of Jesus' first coming. You know, there's a star in the sky, a baby in a manger. It's soft, it's gentle, it's nice. But the description of the second coming is drastically different. I mean, you know, it's everything is shaking. It's earthquakes. The stars are falling out of the sky. Things are going dark. And then the Son of Man comes in clouds with power and glory. It's ominous, and it's also just kind of bizarre. It sounds strange. And so people for centuries have really tried to explain it away. And the primary way people have tried to do it is just by simply saying, look, Jesus taught a lot of great things, but his vision about the future was just wrong. I mean, he just got it wrong. And they go to verse 30 to prove their point. Truly, I tell you, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. They say, look, Jesus was convinced that his second coming would occur before that generation passed away. So he was a great man, and he taught some great things, but he just got that wrong. That's not what happened. And I would suggest that that idea is wrong. That idea is not in accordance with what Jesus taught in Matthew 13, nor is it in accordance with what the church has taught for 2,000 years. The idea that verse 30 shows us that, well, Jesus didn't quite understand when he was going to come back, and you know, he was confused about that, that is really wrong. And N.T. Wright and lots of other scholars help us to see what's going on. Remember, Jesus is answering a question. And what's the question that he's answering? Verse 2, when will the temple be destroyed? Jesus says, look, it's going to be destroyed. Verse 4, they say, when will these things happen, right? When will the destruction of the temple happen? And then Jesus launches into this teaching about the destruction of the temple and ultimate judgment day. And it's very difficult sometimes to even discern, like, now, what is Jesus exactly talking about? Which one is he talking about? But the clue is in verse 30, and it's that phrase again, these things. It's as if Jesus is looking back on his teaching, and he says, look, I'll tell you when these things, when the destruction of the temple, when Jerusalem will be destroyed, I'll tell you when these things are going to happen. They're going to happen in your lifetime, in your generation. And you know what? He was right. In 70 AD, the Roman general Titus and his troops came into Jerusalem and destroyed the city. They destroyed it. They flattened the entire city. They destroyed the temple. And what's more, not only did they destroy the temple, but interestingly enough, the temple has never been rebuilt. It was the end of the temple as the center of religious life in Jerusalem. You know, the doctrine of the second coming is a crucial part of the Christian faith. You know, it's in the creed. He will come again to judge the living and the dead. And that's because it's referenced 300 times in the New Testament. 300 times. And Jesus teaches about it over and over again. So it's not just some kind of fringe idea. It's actually core to the gospel message. Christ has died. Christ is risen. Christ will come again. So let's think about our second question. So, okay, you've convinced me. I believe it. But who cares? Like, what difference does it make to me now? Why should I care about it now? Well, it makes a big difference. It makes a big difference, I can think of, in three ways. One, it makes a big difference in how we engage the world. How we engage the world. Verse 26, at that time, people will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. We hear the word clouds, we typically think of like clouds in the sky, weather. You know, there's a lot of clouds. Maybe it's going to rain. Well, in this particular context, when you have a religious teacher, a rabbi, talking about God coming in clouds, their first association was not weather or some meteorological event. They were taken to Exodus chapter 13. By day, the Lord went ahead of them in a pillar of cloud to guide them on their way. The cloud is the presence of God. And so when Jesus says he's coming in clouds, he's bringing the presence, the power, and the glory of God. He's bringing those things to set the world right. Jesus will bring God's presence, his power, to renew and restore the world. The language in Revelation, he will make all things new. So what does that have to do with our cultural engagement? Well, everything. Let me ask you just a simple question. Like, what motivation do we have to work for God's justice and peace in the world if in the end the world's just going to go, bah! I mean, seriously, like, what good is it? I mean, not much. If there is no end to which it's headed, other than just destruction, what's the point? But that's not the case. God has good plans for his world. You know, through Christ, God is going to bring healing and restoration. And this is why Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 15, always give yourselves fully to the work of the Lord, because you know that your labor in the Lord is not in vain. It's not in vain. The second coming encourages us to work for the Lord and for his purposes, because it's not in vain. It will last. God is going to renew and restore this world. Now, the second difference that it makes to us now is to our personal integrity, not just to how we engage the world, but to how we live personally. Verse 32, but about that day or hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. Now, that's an amazing statement. Two things we can be sure of about the second coming. Jesus says it's going to happen, and you don't know when. You don't know when. And that should be another clue. How do we know Jesus in verse 30 isn't talking about, you know, when will these things happen? It'll happen in your lifetime. How do we know he's not talking about the second coming? Because then in two verses later, he says, I don't know when it's going to happen. Well, if he says, I don't know it's going to happen, then why would he, two verses earlier, be saying, well, it's going to happen, you know, in the next 40 years? No, he does. He says, I don't know when it's going to happen. The earthly Jesus did not know. It could be any time. And so when you put those two things together, it's going to happen, but you don't know when, it becomes a motivation for personal integrity. C.S. Lewis, he says in his essay, The World's Last Night, he says, precisely because we cannot predict the moment, we must be ready at all times. The sentry does not know at what time the enemy may attack or when an officer might inspect his post. So he must be awake at all times. We must therefore train ourselves. I love this. We must therefore train ourselves to ask more and more often how the thing we are saying or doing or failing to do at each moment will look when the irresistible light streams in upon it. So the second coming makes a big difference in our way we engage the world. It makes a difference in our personal integrity, but it also makes a difference in enabling us to forgive and to be people of peace. Here's how it works. When someone wrongs us, when someone hurts us, we very naturally run to the judgment seat and we're ready to pronounce punishment upon our offender for his or her wrong toward us. Right? It's just a very natural thing to do. It's like an instinct. We think that we know what they deserve, and we want to help them get it. But there's a problem. We're not equipped to judge. The seat is too big. It will poison our lives if we try to sit on it. You know, if we refuse to forgive, it will ruin our lives. And we know this not just theologically. We know this in practice. We see people who just refuse to forgive, and they just live in bitterness. And we know what it does to people. This is why Jesus says, do not judge. This is why James asks us, who are you to judge your neighbor? So we must not judge. But how can we resist that very natural impulse? Well, it begins by realizing that we don't need to judge because Jesus will. Jesus will. He will come again in glory to judge. To judge the living and the dead. So we can be at peace knowing that Jesus is going to sort it all out. You know, no one is going to get away with anything, okay? We can just rest easy. Jesus is coming back, and he's going to set things right. And setting things right requires some kind of judgment, doesn't it? I mean, just the very fact that there is something called right and wrong means that we have judgment. You know, for example, Jesus doesn't like oppression. He doesn't like it when people are oppressed. So therefore, he is going to judge those who take advantage of the poor and the weak. You get the point. To set things right, there has to be judgment. And so when Jesus comes again, that's why we say he will come again to judge the living and the dead. And since Jesus is coming as judge, that means we are free to forgive and to make peace. We don't have to rush to the judgment seat because that's where Jesus is going to sit. So the second coming is really central to the gospel message. And it makes a big difference in how we live now. And so let's go on to our last question. How can we, you know, the Bible says that we should eagerly anticipate, you know, this whole season of Advent, anticipation. We're longing for, we're waiting for Jesus to come. Well, how can we be eager for the second coming? Because I think we all intuitively know there's kind of a problem. We kind of are in a difficult situation. On the one hand, the world desperately needs judgment, right? There's actually, I will tell you this, there's no hope for the world if there's no judgment. Like there can be no setting of things right if there's no judgment. And if there's not going to be any setting of things right, then that just means, you know, it is what it is. It's not going to change. So we need judgment to have hope for the world. But then we have to ask ourselves, well, but if there's going to be judgment, what hope is there for us? Like, how are we going to stand judgment? He will come again to judge the living and the dead. Who does that include? That's pretty all-encompassing. That's you. That's me. I think of Psalm 130, verse 3. It's a very piercing question. If you, Lord, kept a record of sins, who could stand? Who could stand? Now, imagine if every time you thought or said, you should or you ought, and then just fill in the blank, right? Kirk, you should do this. Or you shouldn't do that, or whatever. Imagine if every time you had that thought or said that, it was recorded. Jesus had a recording of it. And so your standard for how everyone else should live was recorded for all time. And then Jesus returns, and you stand before him, and he says, you know what? I'm gonna cut you some slack here. I'm gonna be so fair you can't believe it. I'm not gonna judge you by my standards. I'm not gonna get out the Ten Commandments. I'm not gonna do anything. I'm just gonna judge you by the standard that you judged everyone else. I'm not gonna judge you by my standards. I'm just gonna judge you by your own standards. Let me tell you, not one human being would stand. Not one of us even consistently lives by our own standards. Isn't that true? It's absolutely true in my life. I'll tell you that. We don't even live by our own standards, let alone God's standards. So how are we going to stand Judgment Day? Because we can't eagerly long for the second coming until we can figure that out. So in Mark 13, we read, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars are going to fall from the sky, everything is going to be shaken. When Jesus returns, brings judgment. That's Mark 13. Then Mark 15, we read, things are being shaken and darkness comes over the entire land. In Matthew 24, which is the parallel to Mark 13, where Jesus is, again, teaching about his second coming, we read, we read about earthquakes, we read about shaking. And then we go forward from Matthew 24 to Matthew 27. And we read, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook, the rocks split, and the tombs broke open. Well, when did that happen? It happened when Jesus on the cross cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And you say, the description of that day sounds like what Jesus was talking about Judgment Day. And that's because it was. It was judgment come down on Jesus Christ. How can we be eager, filled with anticipation, longing for the second coming? Because Jesus, out of his great love for us, was willing to suffer for us. He suffered judgment for us. At his second coming, Jesus is going to bring judgment. At his first coming, he came to bear it. At his second coming, he is coming to bring the presence of God, because at his first coming, he suffered the absence of God. My God, why have you forsaken me? The great judge of the world was willing to be judged for us. You know, in Revelation, the Apostle John has this great vision. And in the vision, he sees the throne, the judgment seat. And who is seated there? A lamb. Isn't that odd? A lamb. Then I saw a lamb looking as if it had been slain, standing at the center of the throne. I looked and heard the voice of many angels. Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and praise. Jesus is the Lamb who was slain, so that with the Apostle Paul, we can say, and now the prize awaits me, the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give me on the day of his return. And the prize is not just for me, but for all who eagerly look forward to his appearing. So will you please stand and take in your bulletin, open it up to page 6, and we're going to say together the Apostles' Creed. We're going to do it in a responsive format. But we're going to do this because, you know, it's important that we understand what the Creed teaches us, because the Creed has always been for the church a summary of what, you know, what's important. What are the things we really have to hold on to about who God is and what he's doing in the world? And the Creed is that summary. It helps us to know what the church has always believed is kind of the essential about God. So let's say this together. Do you believe in God the Father?
I believe in God the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth.
Do you believe in Jesus Christ, the Son of God? Do you believe in God, the Holy Spirit?